I started wondering. I took a bite of my ice cream bar and watched as Lena did the same. What would lunch have been without dessert? Second, Cordero said that Devon had dark hair, but it was blonde. And third, the blue tie. When I spoke with Devon, he said that he hadn't been home and that he was still wearing the same clothes. At the ballpark, his tie was red. We were sitting on a bench in Logan's Circle, watching the fish and swans blow water 20 feet in the air, as if the humidity needed any help. Individually, it's not much, but all together. Of course, now that Devon's picture's plastered across every newspaper in town, it'll probably be harder to find the mystery man. Whoever he is, if he's smart, he'll fold up the tents and head home. What if he was just some passerby? I mean, it is a big city. I don't think so. There weren't any functions at the Institute that night, so why would anyone be hanging around the museum steps? How would he know Devon's name? And why did he identify himself as Devon Conliffe? I leaned back on the bench and took another bite of my ice cream. I thought about it as I looked at the nearest Indian in the Fountain of Three Rivers. He was representative of the Delaware River and had more than a passing resemblance to Henry. Maybe after Devon ran, the other fellow decided to pin him to the incident.
Then disappeared himself?
Evidently he had something to hide, too. I finished my ice cream and was chewing on the stick. We are looking for a Caucasian male, approximately 30 years of age, dark hair, and at least 6 feet tall.
You think the mystery man had something to do with Devon's death?
I could feel the wood beginning to splinter between my teeth. It makes sense. Somebody cares enough about Katie to follow her, cares enough to chance revealing himself after she's hurt, and cares enough to possibly toss Devon off the bridge. She finished hers.
That's a lot of caring.
Yep.
Are you still hungry?
Hmm? She smiled.
You're chewing the stick, and I thought you might want something else to eat.
I dropped it in the nearest trash can. Henry was with Katie this morning, and I wanted to get back to the hospital before he had to leave for the museum, but Lena was doing so much. I took a deep breath. You want to tell me about this affair? She laughed, then looked at me through the corner of an almond-shaped eye.
I wasn't sure if you remembered that part of the conversation.
I'm pretty good with details, especially those involving domestic disturbances. She looked at the Indian maiden leaning modestly on her side against an excited swan. I had read the plaque after we had crossed the street and knew that the young girl represented Wissahickon Creek, but in Lena Moretti's mind, she was possibly emblematic of something more.
It was 8 years ago. Victor had made inspector and just started working with the mayor's task force on organized crime. He wasn't home a lot, and I guess I got bored.
I waited, but she didn't say anything else. It sounds like there's more to this story.
She continued to watch the fountain. There is, but that's probably all you need to know.
I waited a respectful moment before replying, "Okay." I watched the people around the fountain, and it was only after a moment that I realized I was looking for a 30-year-old male with dark hair and a darker reflection. When I looked back, she had turned toward me and was smiling.
Who's got the afternoon shift?
I do, but if you could check on Dog and cover for me for a little while this evening, I'd really appreciate it. The smile held.
Buy me dinner?
I looked back at the Indians. Sure. She tossed her stick into the trash can as well and stood. She looked exactly like Vic.
My pick.
I put Lena in a cab and grabbed one going in the opposite direction for myself. It didn't take long to get to Spring Garden, and I felt a release doing something to track down some answers. Tactical training specialists was the only going concern on the block, with gratings over the windows and a door that would have been more appropriate back home at Fort Fetterman. It didn't look like the best part of town.
The sign on the glass read, Retail Handgun Sales, New and Used, Home Defense Classes, Indoor Shooting Range, and Basic through Advanced Training. There was an adjacent parking lot with a side entrance that probably led to the range. I tried to remember what Katie had said about the instructor, but could only come up with him being ex-army and a pretty good shot. I wondered casually how he handled throwing bodies over bridges. I pushed the door open and an entry bell sounded. There was every gun I'd ever seen lined against the walls all the way to the back of the place. Glass-topped counters held the handguns, while the rifles and shotguns stood at attention, chained to the racks behind the counters. There were displays of body armor and home security sensors with locks and alarms at the center of the shop, along with three-dimensional targets and gun safes. "Can I help you?" Jimmy Tomko was a little younger than I was, of average height and build, with a light complexion and pattern balding that did nothing to hide the fact that he was missing his left ear. It also looked like he had a glass eye. He was sitting on a stool behind the counter and to my right, where he could see whoever walked in before they could see him. I noticed he was wearing a shoulder holster with a Kimber 45 and was reading the Daily News, which was folded back to the second page and the continuation of the Devon Conliff saga. I extended my hand. "Walt Longmire. My daughter's Katie Longmire." He smiled without parting his lips. "Hello, Sheriff." We went to his office, which overlooked the firing range, and he told me about his experiences in Quang Tri Province, which ended with a pressure-detonated mine made from one of our duds, a 105-millimeter round that had been booby-trapped. "Roughly two platoons had walked right by the damn thing, and I was next to last when the guy beside me stepped on something and I turned." He gestured toward his left eye. "Poached my eye just like an egg. They say the sand was probably the only thing that saved me and the guy in front of us." I didn't ask about the fellow who had stepped on it. Not for the first time, I was anxious to get out of Vietnam, so I changed the subject. "Jimmy, how long have you had this place?"
"Since 77.
He gestured toward the shooting gallery.
"Put the firing range in about 10 years ago, and it's been the only thing that saved my butt."
"That many people want to learn how to shoot?"
"There's that, but it's also the permits."
I looked at him questioningly.
"A lot of these yuppies want concealed permits, but the chances of getting one in the city, even with training, are about as likely as Wilson Good joining the Strategic Air Command."
I vaguely remembered an instance in the city involving the ex-mayor, a helicopter, a bomb, and a housing project, and deduced that getting a concealed weapon permit in Philadelphia was nigh on impossible. "So can they get limited permits through you?"
"Yeah. That way they get to transport the weapon to and from the premises within a locked case in the trunk of their car, ammo separate."
"I gather that some of them have been abusing the privilege?" He sighed.
"I had been making good money until we had a prominent assistant district attorney who unloaded on a Toyota station wagon on Roosevelt Boulevard. He said a couple of guys had chased him at speeds in excess of 100 miles an hour.
I thought about it. I wasn't aware that Toyota station wagons could go 100 miles an hour.
He said it was drug dealers.
I thought about it some more. Is the Toyota station wagon the vehicle of choice for Philadelphia drug dealers?
No. So then he said it could have been the KKK, except that in the earlier statement he said the two occupants were not white."
Tomko watched me with the one eye.
"Now, there could be two non-white members of the KKK cruising around Philly in a Japanese station wagon, but there's just as much a chance of Wilson Good joining the Strategic Air Command."
"Exactly." I was getting the hang of it.
"Now, you are probably wondering why it is that I have told you the story."
He angled the front page of the paper toward me. I stared at him. "Devon Conliff?" He nodded.
"He was in the car with ADA Vince Osgood, a buddy of his."
"What were they doing, being chased by drug dealers?"
"There were a lot of questions along those lines."
He dropped the corner of the paper back on his desk.
"Surprise, surprise, the charges were dropped. I think it might have been because Devon's father, the judge, had pull with the court."
"His father?" Tomko nodded.
And Devon still came here?
Lawyer League, they all come in on Thursdays.
He sat back in his chair and leaned a scarred chin on his fist.
They didn't cancel his permit, and like I said, all the charges were dropped.
I thought about the judge's son.
So he might have been involved in some things he shouldn't have been?
It's likely.
Can you think of anybody who might have wanted to kill him?
The one eye stared at me for a while.
Besides me?
About half of Philadelphia.
He looked away for a second.
Look, I know your daughter was dating the guy, but he was a piece of shit. Did you ever see the two of them together?
No.
Not for nothing, but it was like she was his personal servant.
His eye came back to me.
Why don't you ask your daughter?
I studied him, but could tell nothing.
I'm saving that as a last resort.
He nodded.
I'm not so sure why it is you're concerned. Best thing that could have happened to her.
He cleared his throat and shrugged.
Sheriff, in case you hadn't noticed, your daughter's quite a looker. Intelligent, and possibly one of the best shots I've ever had the pleasure of not teaching.
He folded his hands in his lap.
It's none of my business, but I think she's a lot better off.
I withheld comment.
You mind if I come in tomorrow night?
Nah, but there's a guest fee. $30 plus ammo. What do you shoot?
A .45 ACP.
He nodded. The caliber probably reminded him of Quang Tri, landmines, and poached eggs.
It was close to 1 o'clock when I got back to the hospital. When do I get to meet the mother?
I ignored Henry and watched Katie.
Anything?
No. But I sang to her all morning.
I sat down.
Thank you.
His eyes stayed on Katie.
She hears us.
I had thought about it a great deal, but I wasn't sure.
You think?
Yes.
He exhaled a short laugh.
This may be your only chance to get the first, middle, and last word.
He looked at me now, his eyes steady.
She must hear our voices, so that she can return to us.
I thought what a wonder it was that this individual should be with me here now. Even as a child, he had always known something the rest of us didn't. I thought about the book I'd brought from Wyoming, the love-worn collection of Shel Silverstein's poetry. Maybe I could read her that.
Well, I don't sing. Any suggestions on what I should say?
He smiled. Tell her how much you love her. Everything after that is small talk.
I talked to Katie for the next 4 hours, and then the nurses ran me off so that they could bathe her. I took my chair and sat in the hallway. The Daily News was at the nurse's desk, so I appropriated it. Judge's son dies in bridge fall. I studied the photo of Devon Conliff. It was most likely a publicity shot from his firm. There was no denying that he was a handsome kid, but there was a wayward quality to the eyes, something that said the young man was looking for a way out. I guess he found it, or it found him. I looked at the picture of the bridge that had a superimposed dotted line of his fall and an arrow showing where he had landed. I thought about the alley where I had spoken to the cop with the donut and made a mental note to return there in the morning when the police and the crime lab people had cleared out. 10 p.m., as the traffic grew sparse on the Benjamin Franklin Bridge, Devon Conliff, son of Judge Robert Conliff, fell to his death. The article was pretty straightforward, concentrating on Devon's career in the law and on the assorted community services he was involved with, only mentioning the episode that Jimmy Tomko had described as the incident on Roosevelt Boulevard. Robert Conliff was quoted as saying that his son was a good man and an excellent lawyer who would be sadly missed in society. There was no mention of Katie. I figured the Conliffs and I were off for dinner. The Roosevelt Boulevard thing bothered me.
I needed to find out more about Devon's background. I knew two detectives who might help me out. I dug Katie's cell phone from my jacket, but the battery was dead. I put it back in my pocket and settled on brooding, something at which I was pretty good. It was possible that what had happened to Devon had been triggered by what had happened to Katie, but not exclusively. It appeared that the young man could have been involved in any number of situations that could have led to his violent end. The nurses had finished. I folded the paper, placed it back on the counter, and leaned my elbows on the ICU desk. Nancy Lyford, the head nurse, the one who had held my hand when we had first arrived, came over and stood by me.
"Your friend has a beautiful voice."
"Yep, he does."
"He's Native American?"
I smiled. "Indian, yes."
"Isn't Native American the correct term?"
"I suppose, but most of the Indians I know would laugh at you if you used it." I figured I'd better explain. Most Indians don't identify themselves as American particularly, but as members of nations unto themselves. She looked at me blankly. "A nation? Like a tribe?" She thought about it.
"He said he was Cheyenne?"
"Northern Cheyenne and Lakota."
"Sioux?"
I shook my head. "You start calling Lakota the Sioux, and you're going to get in real trouble." She laughed.
"Sounds more complicated than Native American."
I gestured toward my daughter. "How's she doing?" She glanced over her shoulder.
The bilateral constriction subsided to a normal reaction of the pupils, which gives her a much better opportunity of recovery. The involuntary response to external stimuli is also a very good sign.
It was basically the same speech I'd gotten from Rissman the day before, and I wasn't sure if that was good or bad. "Still a wait-and-see situation?" She nodded her head and looked a little sad.
"It's not like television. It's a long process that takes a lot of effort, even if things go well."
I nodded, and she looked back at Katie.
"I'm not sure if now is the time to mention it, but the things that people have been sending and bringing are beginning to pile up."
I guess I still looked blank.
"Cards, stuffed animals, flowers, and things like that."
She smiled.
"She's a very popular young woman."
I had the flowers donated to other units and started to put the rest into a large shopping bag the head nurse thoughtfully provided. I was still talking to Katie. "I've half a mind to leave all this stuff here and have you lug it all home yourself." There were stuffed animals, mostly indicative of the West, buffalo, horses, and a bear. There were assortments of candy and a stack of cards, most of which had her name on them, except for one that had mine. I held the little envelope up for her to see. "There! I'm popular, too." It was the usual size of a thank-you note, with a mechanical typewritten print that read Sheriff. I nudged my thumb under the flap and opened the sealed envelope. Inside was a plain white card that looked like the ones used for names at a place setting. It read, in the same type, "You have been done a favor. Now drop it." I looked at it for a long time. I finally noticed that my finger and thumb were holding the card like a life preserver. I guess I thought that if I let go, the card might disappear. I studied the envelope. There was nothing to indicate where the note had come from or whom it was from. I held it up to the fluorescent light and could see the indentation of the mechanical typewriter's strike, worn with a small dropout at the bottom of the O. A typewriter? No one used one of those anymore. I stood and walked out to the nurse's station. I held up the envelope. "Excuse me, but do you have any idea where this one might have come from?" She shook her head.
"No, I really can't say."
"Can you check with the rest of the staff and see if any of them remember anyone bringing this particular envelope?" She reached for it.
"Certainly."
I held on. "I need to keep this, but there aren't any others that are typewritten. Do you think you could bring them here or describe it to them?" She looked uncertain. "It just says Sheriff in capital letters."
"Yes."
She continued to sit and look at me. "I mean, now."
The other three staff members who were on the floor had never seen the note, and after a few phone calls, it was ascertained that the others hadn't either. I plucked a card from my wallet, looked at the great seal of the city of Philadelphia, and thought about the deep-set eyes that had watched me so carefully this morning. Asa Katz, Detective, Homicide Unit, 8th and Race. There were four different phone numbers, and I didn't call any of them. I was standing with the head nurse in Katie's room when Lena Moretti arrived. The sun had set, but the last of its golden light reflected off the other sides of the building in a burnished brilliance of dying illumination, peaking and then dimming, like a thought having passed.
No, I didn't write it.
I reached out and held Katie's foot. I felt the momentary reflex of response and the heat in my face as I looked at hers. Well, I just wanted to give you the chance to give yourself up. I heard her exhale with a smile.
What are you going to do?
I gave a little laugh myself. You know, your daughter asks me that a lot. The hot spots of the sun were reflecting back to my mountains in Wyoming, and I thought about how deceptively simple life seemed there. I figure I'll give the detectives a full report in the morning.
Yeah, but what are you going to do tonight?
She was holding the card and stood in the golden light with her other hand propped at the small of her back.
That note seems to indicate that Devon Conliffe's death is a direct result of Katie's accident.
I smiled at the floor tile some more and didn't answer. I stood there with the Cheyenne Nation, looking up at the tall building in the night sky. Are you going to tell me that this is a bad idea, too? He considered the streetlights running down Market.
Nah, this is a good idea.
Now I was worried. The clouds hadn't given way to the moon and were still skimming along the tops of the buildings and reflecting the city's light. It was a warm, balmy evening, and with the cloud cover, everything felt close. I looked at my pocket watch and glanced down both sides of the city street. Patty, with an eye, was to have met us at 9 o'clock, but it was creeping up on 15:15. You think she changed her mind? He didn't say anything, just looked off toward City Hall. He looked remarkably like the Indian at Logan Circle.
For what exactly are we searching?
I don't know. That's why we have to look for ourselves. His eyes turned to me.
You do not think the police have already done this?
I'm sure they asked some questions, but that's probably all. It's hard to deal with lawyers without a warrant. He looked back at the building.
Which is why we are breaking and entering?
Just entering. I'm not planning on breaking anything. He nodded, but didn't look particularly convinced. It was just then that the woman I assumed was Patty turned the corner and approached from the plaza on Broad. She was looking around as she crossed the street.
I'm sorry, I had trouble getting a babysitter.
She stopped talking and looked at Henry. The Indian had that kind of an effect on people east of the Mississippi River. Patty, with an eye, I'm Walt, and this is Henry Standing Bear. He inclined his head, extended a hand, and smiled while she melted into the cracks of the sidewalk.
Patty with an eye, I have heard a great deal about you.
I rolled my eyes and converted it into a glance through the revolving doors at the lobby, where a couple of security guards sat at a centrally located desk between the banks of elevators. I wondered mildly if we might have been better off leaving the Cheyenne Nation out of the equation. Once inside, Patty just waved at the men. I noticed one of them was reading the Philadelphia Inquirer, which had a more demure take on the Devon Conliffe saga. The other looked at us a little quizzically, but made nothing more of it. We watched as Patty punched the up button, and we got on the elevator as she slipped a security card into the panel and hit a red one marked 32. We got off and followed her to a set of opaque glass doors where she inserted the card again. The doors buzzed. I pushed one, only partly open. This is as far as you go. She looked up at me. I shook my head. It's bad enough that the guards have seen you with us. If we get caught,
I don't want you anywhere near.
You're not going to know what to look for.
I glanced over at Henry. We'll have to take that chance. She sighed.
Her office is straight down the hall past the library, then take a right and go to the corner. She's the next-to-last door on the left.
I saluted, and we waited till she was gone. I turned to look at Henry. I like to ask myself, what would Jerry Spence do in a situation like this?
Jerry Spence would not be in a situation like this.
The main hall was a straight shot to a conference room. The lights were all on, and I expected somebody to cross at any second and turn to look at us. I waited a moment, then stepped into the entryway and looked both left and right down the first intersecting hallway. There seemed to be three more before the end. We listened, but the only sound was the heating, cooling air handlers. I watched as Henry took his rightful place at the front, always the scout. He advanced to the next intersection and motioned for me to follow, never taking his eyes off the area ahead. I moved out and up behind him as he crossed and continued. We were at the doorway of the library when he stopped and angled his head in the direction of the opening. I expected to hear the shriek of lawyers aware that they were being attacked by a war party, but it was silent. I waited as Henry held up a fist, then a single finger, and then the fist again. Hold, one person, stay there. I waited as he crossed and peered into the room from the opposite angle. I watched as the dark eyes flicked around. He froze for a second, then slowly turned away and placed himself flat against the far wall. I did the same. I listened more carefully as someone rustled some papers and walked through the room about 20 feet from the door. After a moment, and more than most white men would wait, the bear inclined his head and looked into the library. He glanced back and gestured for me to come along. I crossed and followed him to the far corner where he stopped and once again looked both ways. Every light in this part of the damn place was on as well, and I started wondering how much Schomburg, Calder, Dallin, and Rind could shave off their billing by turning them out. Paintings on the walls in the corridor that led to Kitty's office were abstracts of what I took to be Indians. When I turned to look at Henry, he was studying the nearest one, looked at me, and shrugged. To my relief, most of the doorways leading to the right were either dark or closed. Seeing the lights from the other tall buildings glide past as we worked our way down the hall was making me dizzy, so I was glad when we got to the door that read Katie Longmire on a little brass plaque. The door that was three before Katie's was open with the light on. The plaque on it read Joanne Fitzpatrick. The name sounded familiar. Henry turned the knob to Katie's office and closed the door behind us after I followed him in. It was a small room, and we stood there for a moment to let our eyes adjust to the darkness. I could feel some of Katie's clothes hanging on the back of her door and steadied there swinging with my hand. Henry stood slightly to the left, looking out the floor-to-ceiling glass wall ahead of us. William Penn and City Hall were to our right, and the yellow glow of the clock below Penn told us it was a time when all good lawyers should be home and in bed. The bluish light of the building across Market reflected the streetlights below and the image of the building we were now in. Henry reached across the shadow of a desk and clicked on a green tortoiseshell lamp. The illumination was ample, but not so much that it reached the space under the doorway. I breathed the first deep breath since entering the offices. "Somebody was in the library?"